broadcasting to you from Seattle, Washington. This is West Coast Radio. My name is Matthew. I am the host of the program, and joining me on the show today is Lex Vaughn. I'm real excited about this. Lex Vaughn is the founder and editor of The Needling, Seattle's only real fake news. If you haven't heard of The Needling, you're probably not from the Pacific Northwest, but regardless, it's very similar in style to The Onion. So as an example, when Jeff Bezos was up in space, The Needling came out with the headline, "Independent Intergalactic Bookstore Already Out of Business." You know, hilarious, funny, universally relatable shit like that is what you can expect day in and day out when consuming The Needling. Where can you find The Needling, you ask? Instagram at The Needling, or you can go to TheNeedling.com, TheNeedling.com. They got a writing workshop coming up September 14th. You can't learn how to write a joke on your own. You got to find a sensei to help you. There are very particular tools, and if you don't learn them, it's going to be very difficult. So they got that going on starting September 14th. Also, they have a podcast, which I'm real excited for, The Needling Update. And you can find all of that stuff on TheNeedling.com. I learned a lot during this interview. I think I came out of it a much better interviewer, just from the lessons that I learned and everything. So, you know what? I'm very grateful is what I'm trying to say for this conversation that I had. It was really important to me, and I couldn't have asked for a better guest than Lex Vaughn for this show. So, let's get right into it. This is West Coast Radio. Joining me on the show today is Lex Vaughn. She is a Pulitzer Prize winning, is it Pulitzer? Is that how you pronounce it?
Pulitzer, yeah.
Pulitzer Prize winning journalist, as well as editor and creator of The Needling, Seattle's only real fake news. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
As I was telling you before, I just think you're fucking hilarious. You make me laugh. And also, I think part of it is this. The mark of a really, really great entertainer, I think, is can you, especially when you're talking to a broad audience, can you touch on something they can all go, oh shit, I know exactly what she, you know, she's talking about, whoever the writer is. And you just get me. I feel like you just get me. So I you make me laugh every single day. Also, this is inappropriate, but I don't know if you've ever thought about this. I'm wondering how many people, like, it's a weird stat, but you know, out of the, I wonder how many people you make laugh, like, on the toilet in the morning. Cause it's news, you know what I mean?
I mean, it's like anytime people are, you know, enjoying content on their phone, it's like, who the hell knows?
Exactly.
They can be in a lot of weird situations enjoying our stuff.
I mean, what if you've made the most people in Seattle laugh on the toilet? Who knows?
I think there's a good chance.
This is your baby. And I think that's another thing that really impresses me a lot. You know, it takes, especially coming from, you were at the LA Times, you were at the Seattle Times, and, you know, you've achieved the pinnacle of what it means to write for a newspaper. But then you go, okay, you know what? I'm going to do my own thing. Were you scared?
Initially, yeah, really scared. Because even though I've loved comedy like my whole life, you know, just big stand-up fan, you know, SNL fan, you know, all the things. It's like, it is kind of like a bold thing to just be like, yeah, I can be funny. There's a certain amount of like ego and guts it takes to be like, I'm pretty sure I'm funny. And you have to like have faith in yourself to just go ahead and try it. And, you know, sometimes that works out and sometimes it doesn't. And fortunately, in this case, it did. But I also have to give a lot of credit to there's kind of been like a, you know, a cast of people who have contributed to The Needling. They kind of move in and out of, out of writers' roles as their, you know, life changes and everything. But from the beginning, it's always been kind of a collaborative operation where it's not just one person deciding what's funny and that getting published. There's a lot of filtering, coming up with several headlines and then narrowing down which ones really work and resonate with people.
You know, it's so interesting. You ask an artist, do you like do you like your work? Do you like the work that you've produced? Even South Park, they're famous. They think every episode they've made is the worst episode they've ever made, you know?
Yeah, it's so hard. I listen to a lot of kind of comedy podcasts too myself. And it seems like even, you know, my favorite comedians, yeah, are like highly critical of themselves. So it's like, you know, unfortunately, I think when you're trying to always improve and hold yourself to a higher standard, you're always kind of like never quite satisfied with yourself, which makes you better, but it's also uncomfortable because you're always chasing something.
Yeah. You mentioned off the air, how, you know, people need a laugh, especially this past year. And I think also people need to know that some of the most talented people in the whole world, even when they're putting out a project, they still feel, you know, kind of insecure about it. I feel like every episode I made, oh man, I fucked up here, I fucked up there. I never feel like it's that great. I always feel like, oh man, I have so much work to do to improve. But I think for a lot of people at home who maybe haven't taken that leap yet to follow their dream, they go, oh man, what? Lex Vaughn goes, she may not think she's that funny. That, I think, in some ways, really encouraging to people, don't you think?
Yeah. I think what I've learned, and it's like I keep on having to remind myself of it as I try to grow in different ways. It's like anytime you're trying to do something new, you have to allow yourself to suck at first. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people think they can just skip that. It's like, you want to do something new and hard and be good at it? You better have a lot of humility, or you're not going to make it.
I wonder if it was marketing, because growing up, I was under the impression that I had to find something that I was a prodigy in. Like I was going to have to keep trying new things until something was just like everybody around me went, holy shit, look what that kid's doing in that arena. But you realize as you keep progressing, hopefully you realize that really the best in the world are just products of hard work and discipline. It's not like you mm-hmm. were born and God said, that's going to be Leonardo da Vinci. No, Leonardo da Vinci practiced a lot.
Yeah. I mean, it's like a mixture of like, I think sometimes, you know, just conditions of, you know, where you grew up and what kind of family you grew up in, like just things that you were in the midst of growing up, plus hard work can make you a little bit more, you know, better at certain things. It's a mixture of things. But in the end, I think you have to have hard work and like humility to kind of figure out how to be good at something.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Some people are just born a certain, like Elvis and Prince, they're born with a little something, something extra. You know what I mean? They just have it.
Yeah.
One thing that I noticed right off the bat when I consume your material, when I read The Needling, one thing I go, holy shit, that is, it's basically like, it's a Saturday Night Live monologue or a Tonight Show monologue. I mean, the jokes are very similar in that aspect. That's one of the greatest powers that somebody could have as a writer, to be able to write a funny monologue. That's my dream. I've been working on it for years. I'm no good at it. I'm real dog shit. But you know, I feel like that is such a wonderful ability to have. Do you ever submit stuff like simple monologues to the Tonight Show, NBC, anything like that? Because you're so good at those types of jokes.
No, but I've thought about it in the last year. I'm like, you know, like I've been working on this kind of stuff for a while now. Like, why not? So I've looked at some of those options. But the thing is that, you know, ultimately, like I'm a person in her mid-30s. And am I interested in moving to New York City or Chicago, where there's kind of like a center of a comedy scene you need to like network through? And it's like, honestly, I'm not interested in that at all. So I love having my own satirical publication here in Seattle. And I think it's also offered, you know, other people who want to take a swing at writing funny stuff an opportunity to do that. Cause it's like, you know, you can love The Onion and want to write for The Onion, but how do you write for The Onion? Like, even I'm not quite sure yet. It's like, I think to get into certain comedy circles, it's like there's a ton of networking and it's got to be your life. And it's like, I don't really want to like change my life that much. I love doing this, but I kind of want to stay here and, you know, maybe just do my own thing.
It used to be, I think, if you wanted to do something like that for a living, you had to move to New York or Chicago. Yeah. But as I think about it, and as you explain your answer, you don't have to do that anymore. If you want to have a monologue and if you want to make people laugh in that style, shoot, you can do it with your own YouTube channel. You can do it on your website, mm-hmm. The Needling, and it's right at your fingertips. And I want to touch on that just in just a little bit. But for right now, I don't want to come to you empty-handed. So I did write a headline.
You've got humility? Check. right. Go for it. Go for it.
Okay. Before I get to that, I did send in one SNL sketch, and here's just the brief idea. So I sent it to Colin Jost. And,
oh, my gosh. Cool.
Well, I mean, it never got back to me. But here's what it was about. It was about – it happened right after the Capitol attacks, okay? Mm-hmm. So this was – it was going to be some meeting with Congress about what – how do you defend yourself if there's another right-wing extremist attack that happens at the Capitol. So you have this security team, and they tell them that underneath every seat from now on, it's going to be two Confederate flags and a MAGA hat. So like when they run in the room,
oh my
everybody
God.
Just puts a Make America Great Again hat.
I think that's funny.
You know what I mean? So yeah. you just dip your head down. They won't know who to attack.
Oh, you see, I think what makes something like that funny is like the kernel of truth in it. It's like, oh my God, they actually would be safer.
Yeah.
If they had. That's so sad.
Yeah, it's a strange environment we're living in nowadays. All right. Here is my headline. It's kind of dark, but I couldn't come up with anything else. I mean, this works. It's just very dark. That's all I'll say. I'll get right into it. I want to give a quick disclaimer that this interview took place when we had that massive heat wave. It was like 110 degrees in Seattle and really across the country. There was a huge heat dome. And then it was when the Miami condos collapsed, just for a reference. While the rest of the nation melts, Surfside brings Miami an early fall.
Ooh. That took a second.
Yeah.
I had to remember my national news. Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that works. Like the wording of it is clever. And it, I think the only thing my head is still like swirling is like, what's the higher purpose of that joke? Cause I'm all for dark humor and dark headlines, but like, I kind of believe that, underneath every good joke is a good point, like a good truth or something, or that an important truth or something like that. So I'd have to read it again and like ponder it.
That's very curious. Cause me, I was just scrambling to write something that had something clever. But with you, the goal is, cause really with me, there was no fucking higher purpose. It was just, oh, that kind of sounds clever. But of course you have to keep in mind, especially when you're putting something out into the world, these are real people who died, you know, I mean, these are real lives and the rescue is still ongoing. So for you, the goal is, okay, we're not just going to tell people what's going on. There's going to be something else to supplement this news. It's not just in King 5 News today, the sun is hot. You know, it's more than that.
Yeah. So can you read it again?
Yeah, sure, sure. While the rest of the nation melts, Surfside brings Miami an early fall. So it's based off of a haiku that I wrote. I write a haiku every week, and the haiku is the haiku is greased palms, shoddy walls, brings Miami early fall, the rest of us melt. So that's how I came up with it.
I think like this is kind of what I think when I consider like a dark headline. It's like, okay, Surfside brings early fall. Like who actually, I will actually do a lot of research and read articles like who is to blame for that? Is it the city of Surfside? Because if it is, I think that headline works. If it's just a really shitty building manager who didn't fix things when they were supposed to, or I don't know, some entity that was supposed to make sure that place was safe.
This thinking is very foreign to me. It's not like, it's just not something that I had fathomed yet. Did you learn this as a professional journalist, like how to think this way?
Well, yeah, it's like, I think it's like, I have a passion for comedy and a passion for journalism, the value of good journalism. And I think in general, like I have kind of a watchdog attitude. Like I want to get, I think it's like, if you're going to make fun of people or make fun of something, it's like, there has to be a higher purpose. You know, if you're not like shining a light on somebody who wasn't doing their job or somebody who is exploiting something or making just kind of like an innocent, more innocent joke or something, it's like it runs the risk of just being like bullying or mean. And I don't want to ever do that. So it's like when it's a dark joke, I always want to be like, it's got to be clear that there's a higher purpose. Because, like, we've definitely ran, like, some, like, ooh, that's spicy. Mm-hmm. But, like, the reason I run it is always, like, I'm very clear on the underlying point. And it's an important, you know, point. You know, like, I think we ran some really good ones last June, you know, about a year ago, you know, when all hell was breaking loose on Capitol Hill.
Yes.
And some of them were pretty dark, but I think they were on point. So, and I think people who understand dark humor got what we were doing.
So while you were working for the Seattle Times, you won a Pulitzer for covering the Oso mudslide back in 2014. And just briefly, I'm wondering, as a journalist, you're told this is what your project is going to be. And you get to Oso. What is the procedure after that? Like, what do you begin to do when you are on scene for such a crazy event?
Yeah, I went there with a photographer and one of my closest friends, Marcus Yam. We went to Darrington, where not a lot of media was yet, because it was, you had to go take this like 3-hour detour to get to the other side of the mudslide. But it was actually where people were most impacted, and it's where people lost the most friends and family. So we got there really early in the morning and wanted to try to talk to search and rescue before they went out. And I mean, it's like, I know like I'm on this podcast because of a comedy website, but honestly, it's like, this stuff is not funny at all. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's very tragic. So we got there early and started talking to some volunteer firefighters really early on. And we just kind of hung out at this volunteer fire station, keeping tabs of what people were doing throughout the day. And I was like tweeting out new information. I was breaking a lot of news that day, just from over there. And yeah, I mean, it was a very tragic thing to cover. I stayed there for about 2 weeks covering, you know, the recovery and beginning of cleanup. I always struggle to talk about that because, like, often people bring it up as like, wow, like you put a Pulitzer Prize on your resume for that. And I'm just like, I just remember a lot of tragedy. It's not like, yay.
Right. Yeah. Sure. And I can hear it in your voice. And I'm sorry for bringing it up. It's almost a little bit like asking a soldier, you know, tell me about your time in Iraq, I guess.
Well, but I really think that's underestimated. I think a lot of people, I really hate hearing people talk about the mainstream media, like in a lot of villainization of the media, which doesn't just happen, you know, in the Trump cohort. It happens on kind of the liberal end of the spectrum, just throwing all of journalism under the bus. And it's so disrespectful to people who are really doing good journalism, like really doing good work. And you know, from my experience, for not much pay. And there is PTSD to covering difficult stuff like that. Like I definitely had like nightmares after covering that. Yeah.
Right.
It's tough.
Sorry for bringing it back up.
I'm sorry. I don't know how to talk.
No, sure.
It's so hard.
You know, here's the thing that I have to remind people every now and again. Sometimes I remind people, it's my job to ask the questions. I it's not really my job necessarily to, I don't know whether it is or not. I've determined it's not my job to determine whether or not somebody else should tell me, hey, Matthew, back the fuck off. You know?
Oh, I'm not, I'm really, you know what? I'm really not trying to do that. I think it just kind of happens like naturally when I just think about the whole situation.
Yeah. And yeah. Also, and it's not funny, but the thing is with, I've never felt like I owed my audience anything. Like if somebody's funny, I never felt like I owed them a laugh. I just want to tell some fucking stories and chit chat and all that stuff. But I completely understand. If you'll forgive me, I have one more question about journalism and then we're going to get to the needling, the funny stuff. Mm-hmm. All right. So, you know, we talk about tragedy like this and we talk about the impact it can have on people, but there are, I won't use the word bad people out there, but there are people that, let's, for instance, I've grown up in a military family my whole life, and there are some people who can't get enough of war. They sign up for it, and they can't stop signing up for it because it's just, they love it. And that's a fact. Some people love that type of action. And I would assume the same thing is true in journalism. So for some journalists, and I want to know if you've seen this, I would think that when you have major catastrophes, even if it's bad and it includes lots of life of loss of life, there's got to be some journalists out there where they're not happy about the tragedy or the loss of life, but something in them goes, oh shit, it's time to rock and roll when something like that happens. Do you find people like that in journalism?
Yeah. And it's like, I mean, journalism partly needs people like that because who else would do it? who else would go to a war zone? I don't really want to.
Yeah.
I'll tell you that. My friend Marcus that I went to Darrington with and covered the mudslide with, he's out right now as an international photographer for the LA Times, literally like out in Palestine and Afghanistan, just like front lines of crazy stuff right now. And it's his thing, and he's really good at it. I personally, that's not my thing. And honestly, like I decided to leave, you know, like regular newspaper journalism that year that I covered the mudslide because it was taxing to cover that. And then 2 months later, I was covering a school shooting up in Marysville.
Jesus.
And going to the hospital and watching teenage boys just cry hysterically because they watched their friends get shot in the face and they were saying their goodbyes to them at the hospital. And that was kind of a breaking point for me because it was just like, I think I went into journalism to kind of uncover truth and hope people do something about it. But I think when you cover a lot of disturbing stuff for a long time, you know, like school shootings and recognizing how the country isn't doing enough on gun control, it often just feels like, oh, all I'm doing here is just repeatedly covering tragedy and like just not enough is being done. You know, it's like it was just too frustrating.
And you learned that that wasn't for you. And I think also this shows that, you know, probably more than most people, the power of laughter to make somebody feel better. You know what I'm saying?
It's like I had to go the other direction because it was hard for me to like cope with all these, you know, just kind of dark realities that just weren't getting better. Mm-hmm. So like I needed comedy.
Do you know what will go viral and what will not? Because, I mean, you've had shit go viral, and I've never experienced that before. Did you kind of have inklings of, okay, this is going to be really successful, or is it just totally random?
It's a little random, but like I have to like hand it to myself that I think I do have like a good gut instinct for which ones are going to really do well. I generally have a good feeling before I publish them, even though it's hard to, you know, guess all the directions that they'll go. I can never remember our headlines right off the top of my head. I always screw them up. But we had, a really popular headline about a cat during the beginning of the pandemic that went super viral. And I knew that was good. Like I actually didn't write it, but like I put up kind of like the right image with it that I think really made it go farther. But we published that like very quickly. Like that writer like sent it to me and I was like, oh, this needs to go up now. Like the world needs to see this. And it went super viral. Yeah, and then we've had a few others that went super viral locally, especially some headlines about Mayor Durkin.
Jenny Durkin's Heart and Seven Other Places to Cool Off this weekend. Did that one take off pretty quick?
Yeah, it did. I think part of what I take into consideration when we publish headlines is because the internet is just so dynamic. The news cycle is so dynamic. I do try to like publish things at like just the right time, you know, and that was like right at the beginning of our just record-breaking awful heat wave. So that thing got published at just the right time. I often actually, it's not an exaggeration that when I consider what headline to publish each day, I basically always consider the weather. It affects, I think, how people receive the joke.
Wait, what do you mean? Elaborate.
I like there's some days where it's like, oh, it's a kind of a dark headline or something. But, you know, that day is like the first nice day we've had in like weeks or something. I'm like, I can't publish this today. I got to just let people be happy today. We'll do it tomorrow.
And in this journey, have you had to learn about the algorithm, you know, like the infamous algorithm at all? Do you like try to manipulate that, or do you just put the content out there and then if people share it, they share it? What is your technique there?
I think there's not a lot of careful manipulation. I think most of it is like, A, we go through a process of filtering which headlines work. Like we've got kind of like a crew of like contributors who vote on headlines, and we get an idea of like, okay, that one really resonates. So that's like the first filtering of like, okay, that's a good headline. And then I've realized that I think the best time to publish is like late afternoon, early evening. Cause I think people like, they're like, I'm a serious, you know, person getting work done during the day. And then, you know, by the end of the day, you know, they're just a little bit more like open to being playful or like, I'm sick of work. I'm sick of doing this. I need to laugh now. I need to like kind of cool off. And so I think we mostly publish things about late afternoon, early evening. So I think that's actually the most key thing we've figured out. Just narrowing down good headlines and then a good time to post them.
Who are some of your favorite comedian inspirations or comic inspirations?
There's a lot of them. It's like, obviously, you know, The Needling is satire. So we're definitely influenced by, you know, The Onion and Reductress. And then I think we're also influenced by Portlandia. I love Portlandia. Partly because they're doing something similar, but in like a, you know, obviously like a, you know, a produced sketch kind of environment where all the jokes are based in Portland. Like they literally at the beginning of the scene will have like the cross streets of where this sketch is happening. But, you know, like the jokes are kind of like universal enough that you can live in other cities that have a hipster culture to kind of get it. You don't have to live in Portland to get it. So that's kind of a goal for us too, is like, we want to be definitely based here in Seattle. And there's a lot of our jokes that only Seattle people will get. But when it comes to at least like the headline, you know, it's like part of how you know it really works is if people in other cities are beginning to go like, hey, I don't live there, but I think that's funny. And we're getting more of that this last year, which is fun.
Yeah. Seattle's becoming strange on the world stage right now because, number one, we're colossal titans in data and tech, and that only got stronger coming through this whole mess because, you know, data and tech didn't really get affected by COVID so much. And then also, we're on the world stage because of homelessness, whether or not there's misconceptions or not, homelessness and drug abuse and things like that. We're famous for that as well. So I think that one thing that's really interesting about really the skyrocketing success of The Needling is part of it's really great timing. I don't know if Seattle's ever been more famous. Maybe we have, but Seattle is a really big deal on the world stage for two of those major reasons. And do you ever think about that? The timing was pretty good.
I haven't thought about that. Like I think I mostly started it because I thought it would be fun to do here. And I thought there was definitely a need for it. Like before I did it, I would like kind of pitch the idea to friends or people I was, you know, in some like intramural kickball team with or whatever. And every single one of them was just like, yes, oh my God, do it. And I'm like, this is the part where you're supposed to like tell me it's dumb so I don't have to do it. believe in myself and actually follow through. But like everybody had told was like, yes, do it. But that is true that it's like, you know, especially when it comes to like any of our like Amazon or Jeff Bezos like headlines, this area is also a capital to some of the most prominent American billionaires, which is a big deal. Jeff Bezos, Bill Gates, probably forgetting some other that, well, what, Paul Allen's dead.
The Starbucks guy.
He was around for a while. Oh, yeah, Howard Schultz. We got a lot of billionaires here, which is kind of an issue here in this country.
Probably a lot of maybe 100 to 10 millionaires, too, because if you ever go paddleboarding on the Bellevue side of Lake Washington, like, you go, man, there's some wicked money out here.
Yeah, yeah.
When you find yourself getting so successful so quick, do you find that, oh, man, okay, I got into this because I wanted to be funny and entertain people, but now there's all this administrative bullshit that I have to do?
I suck at that so much.
Did that happen to you? It happened to me.
Yeah, I'm still kind of in the midst of struggling through that because I definitely mostly love the role of editor and writer, and I also put together the images. Like, I love all that stuff, like the content. And then business side stuff and email, not so great, but like I need to get better at it. Cause it's like, a lot of people like the needling. So, you know, there's no reason to not take advantage of, you know, kind of growing it a little bit better. So that's a goal for me this year is to get better at some of that stuff.
Being a business person sucks, doesn't it?
I hate it. Does anyone want to do it for me? Let me know.
Jeez, oh, Pete. You know, I'm imagining somebody's going to buy your – or they're going to offer to buy the needling eventually. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that because, like I said, it's just a good fucking product. There's no way around it. And somebody's going to say, hey, I'd like to buy it. I'll keep you on as chief and editor, but we'll take care of all the other stuff. Probably a very mini version of what happened with Bars. Not mini, but – for right now, the first deal will probably be a mini version of what happened to Barstool Sports. They kept Dave Portnoy, the entertainment guy, but he didn't have to do the business stuff anymore. Do you think that you would be interested in selling if somebody offered you a deal like that?
I'd be very nervous about who I let like own this. Because like
it's your baby.
I am also afraid of like, you know, some benefactor being like, oh, I love the needling. Of course I'll subsidize you, sponsor you, whatever, or whatever it is. And then I'm scared that like that person would be like, hey, I got some funny jokes. I think all the jokes should go like this. And I'm going to kill myself now. Mm-hmm. Yep. I'm very picky about the humor and it's like, I don't want anybody pressuring me to publish certain kinds of jokes just because they're a rich person who owns it. My fantasy would be to be bought by like an actual funny person who would respect boundaries there. My fantasy is Tina Fey like buys it.
I hear that.
Yeah. Yeah. I want Tina Fey to be my publisher.
You know, I'll tell you, you to me are like a dawn. You're like a dawn of Pacific Northwest media.
Ooh, cool.
What you represent is, I think, a potential future. I don't know if it's going to be the future, but it's a potential future. And the reason I'm talking to you right now, as an independent podcast person, I came from the world of radio and I saw in my heart, listen, Matthew, it really doesn't make sense to listen to somebody else have to be dragged down by somebody else's boringness and lameness when you could do your own show, it could be your own flavor, and you can distribute it, promote all that stuff. There's no excuses not to put it out there. And I'm not as successful as you are just yet, you know, but I think that having more and more people being brave enough to put their own name out there and try to be successful, it makes our country a more diverse, it makes the palette of American media more diverse.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Great point. Because, I am a woman and, I've definitely experienced some like just irrational, discrimination. And I'm sure, you know, some people would argue with me on that, but I just, I've had, you know, certain positions where it's like, I'm obviously doing a good job. I'm nice. What's the problem here? Why am I not getting more pay? Honestly, it's like another thing is just getting like my idea, the credit for my work and ideas just flat out stolen, you know, by other men in a certain industry. And it's just so nice to like have my own thing and not have to worry about someone above me saying, oh, no, not you, or giving credit for my work to someone else. It's such a relief. You know, if someone's a problem to work with, I don't have to work with them anymore. Yeah, there's a huge relief in doing your own thing.
It's beautiful. I mean, it is unfiltered, completely unique material that answers to nobody. That's the way it should be, I think. And yeah, that's the way it can be if people like you and me, if we just believe in ourselves and work hard. I that's what I think, at least. That's my opinion.
High five.
High five to you.
Yeah.
I want to hear about your future, what you expect the needling to grow into. Are you going to do video, anything like that? I want to know that what your plans are for the future. And then we'll part ways for a little while.
So I think we're going to get back into a podcast game. I dipped my toe in it a little bit earlier this year, which is like a very short pilot episode. And I think I realized afterward that I did want to like maybe branch or grow that podcast into a longer interview type format thing. So I think we're going to be doing some of that this summer. So that's the main thing. And then I'll probably do a more solid attempt at merch this year. It's like, I mean, I've had people ask for merch and it's like, that's my thing. It's like, I suck at the administrative and business side of things.
It's bullshit. It's like, even though
it's like the opportunity is there, I like, it's like, it's just not the part that I like. I have to really push myself there. Yeah.
That's what they say about Jay-Z. They say that Jay-Z, it wasn't talent with him. He was just a wizard businessman. Like he knew how to sell shit and he knew how to move shit and scale.
He's also talented.
That wasn't the defining thing. He was apparently, what everybody says about him is he knew how to make money, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But yeah, of course, very talented.
That's the skill I got to build, definitely. Yeah.
Lex Fawn, it was a real pleasure having you on the show today and getting to know you. Thanks for being here.
Thanks. Nice to speak with you.
And that was the program. Thank you very much once again to Lex Fawn, the founder and editor of The Needling, Seattle's only real fake news, for joining me today on the show. Check out The Needling on Instagram at The Needling or go to www.theneedling.com. TheNeedling.com. Good night, everybody.